From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome back to The Advice Show. This week we're on location from Rudding Park in Harrogate, and I'm joined by Matthew Sinclair, Chartered Financial Planner and Director at Wealth of Advice in the northeast of England. Matthew, thank you very much for joining me. How are Perfect. You?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Yeah. Been a great day so far, so nice to have a chat.
Had some good sessions so far.
Yeah, definitely found it interesting. Always good to hear from some fund managers and, you know, get the insights of what's happening with the markets and people's view for the future.
Yeah, well, it's been quite the year for the market so far, hasn't it? So good time to check in after the summer, I suppose. Can we start by talking firstly a little bit about your firm, or the firm that you work for, Wealth of Advice, sort of the history of it, how you came to be a part of it, and sort of how you feel about the firm and what it's like in its sort of current guise.
Of course, yeah, definitely. So Wealth of Advice was a firm that was set up by Chris Bruard. It was a firm that essentially was a one-man band to start with. And that family sort of ethos has grown quite nicely to a firm now where we've got, 18 members of staff. What we like to do is almost be, fiercely independent and always be looking out for the best interests of our clients. So I joined in 2018, having previously worked for a law firm up in Newcastle, where I had a sort of fantastic sort of grounding and the starting process of getting into the industry. I went through a bit of a midlife crisis and actually did a master's in computer science. And then at the end of that master's, I was actually offered a PhD, and I sort of had a sort of decision to make whether I left the financial services industry completely and went down more of the sort of coding and more of the tech side. And I actually had two CVs at the time, and I was almost, not sure which one to use. But the job at Wealth of Advice came along nicely, where they were almost looking for, support on things like IT and technology, but also still had the financial advice sort of bit at heart. And that sort of story's then grown, where I now don't have any sort of involvement in the day-to-day sort of IT and technology. But still, as we've seen with the industry, AI tools, back office systems, it's been a really important grounding for the firm to grow.
How did it initially help the business, that sort of?
I think it was a perfect sort of synergy, in the sense of you don't have lots of insight and lots of firms that can blend the tech and the IT with the financial advice outcome focus. So I think we're a relatively young firm in terms of our age profile, and I think that also sits well with adopting technology. Again, we've got an app that clients use, and we've got good engagement there. We've also got a YouTube channel where we sort of do a weekly podcast ourselves, which is the Retire Well podcast. And that's been a good way of actually, using what we're good at, but then still focused on clients and sort of the problem solving side of things.
Absolutely. You mentioned in your intro there that you're a fiercely independent firm. How does that sort of take shape? Is that in your investment decisions or sort of clients you take on?
Yeah, I think it's that element that we see lots of bad client outcomes off the back of potential consolidators or people being passed around a little bit like pieces of meat. So we've had lots of client inquiries through the door where it's a case of, I've been with this firm, or my previous advisor was sacked, or something's changed, and I'm looking for an alternative. And then I think sometimes clients find it amazing what good advice looks like. Again, one example sticks in my head where a couple had been looked after by a firm for years, and they'd always focus on the pension, and they'd always, done a half decent job of managing it. But when the consolidator took them over and they looked in the marketplace and talked to us, we then started talking about inheritance tax, about death benefits, about other bits. And they were a bit like, "Ooh, gosh, I don't know. We usually just talk about the pension and the growth and maybe the dogs or the family." So again, for us, it was, how do we open people's eyes to the wider services that we can add and where sort of financial advice can add value. And that's the bit that, you know, our age profile as well means that when people ask about consolidation and selling, well, we would rather be here to look after our clients through their whole, you know, life journey and then through the generations. And Chris often says to me, he wants that sort of supermarket test or butcher's test, that if he bumped into a client in the supermarket, would they have something positive to say about us, or would they almost want to, you know, strangle him because he's
avoid him to go down the other aisle, and
I think that's the case when some people, you know, don't value the personal relationship quite as much. You know, it can be, what can I get from that client rather than what can we achieve working together?
Do you think that personal relationship, that's something that's sort of declining in the industry with the advent of consolidation? And
I think it's a massive risk. I think from our point of view, I can only say that it's what we do well. And again, you know, we like to have a team-based approach, so every client knows at least three people in the firm. And if I'm on holiday, again, sometimes I am.
God forbid.
Well, yeah, sometimes I am answering people's sort of messages on my phone. But again, there's going to be two people in the office who can pick up that inquiry or pick up that thing. And I think, for people, when financial advice is personal, it can be really life-changing events. Again, if someone's got some ill health news, or you know, someone's been made redundant, or other things, there can be serious decisions that have to be made quite quickly. And knowing that someone's always there to deal with it or start the process, I think it is very valuable. So, yeah, I think that's where, you know, one of our sweet spots is being able to be more personal than maybe a big firm. And like, you know, we talked about a little bit there, consolidation sort of dilutes the relationship bit and the track record of looking after someone in a specific way.
Yeah. And I presumably you guys have had offers from consolidators in the past. I mean,
I think that sort of email and that sort of message comes through quite regularly. Again, it's something that, you can see as an industry, you know, there's a lot of grey hair, and you can see why some people, it's very attractive. You know, for us, it's a case of, well, we want to carry on looking after clients. We want to carry on growing the business. And we want to engage with the technology to do that. So I think you can see why firms do it, but you can also see the problems that are created and the issues that they find themselves in.
Yeah. And you mentioned there about growing the business. So I've got some numbers here. I think in 2023, you had around 680 clients. Last year, 740, or that was the estimate. Has that grown again? Is that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair reflection. And I think, especially with things like the podcast that we're doing, we've been really, you know, impressed by the number of inquiries, and also the geographical element of it starts to move away. So I think, you know, it was easy pre-COVID to say, you know, we're based in Durham and we look after people in the Northeast. Yes, you know, might have then family connections and other things, and you might look after the people in London or people around the UK. Now, because of the YouTube videos and more of the content going out there to help educate people or help, you know, tell people who we are, we're then getting inquiries of, you know, had one the other day where it was a lady based down in London and her brother was based in Edinburgh. And she said, oh, well, actually, we can both jump on a train and we can meet you in Durham, and that works perfectly. So
almost halfway.
Exactly. I mean, the idea of, you know, Teams and Zoom, and, you know, COVID's done a lot for that in terms of not needing to see people face to face. But there's still a value in the potential of doing it and being available to offer it. So
there's a limitation, isn't there, to the amount that you can get to know somebody
through. 100%. I mean, I've had, you know, probably there's one client that sticks in my head who I've probably had sort of 40 hours worth of team calls with. Again, that's been perfect for the technical bit and the planning bit. When I've then met her in person, and we then start to talk more about the soft bits and the family bits and other bits, where it's just like almost, oh, this might be a silly question, but can you help with this, or do you know anyone in this sector? And it almost takes the, you know, planning and the opportunities to the next level, really.
Yeah. How's the sort of client bank changed from a sort of demographic point of view? You mentioned that you have the defined benefit transfer permissions that suggests that your client base is quite old, or it's sort of been in the workforce quite a long time.
There's a lot of money in pensions and in retirement. So, you know, a financial advisor will often have, you know, that focus. But I think we are seeing more inquiries from younger people with high salaries who are trying to manage the tax implications, manage pension contributions. And we're also doing lots more inheritance tax planning where you're trying to engage with the next generation as well. So I think if we'd had this conversation, you know, a few years ago, you would probably say, you know, pensions and retirement is the main bulk of the business. Now, you know, things like offshore bonds, things like inheritance tax planning, things like discounted gift trusts, there's a lot more strings to a bow for, you know, holistic advice. So I think that does change slightly, but you know, as I heard in one of the sessions earlier today, a lot of the generational wealth still sits with that older generation with likes of pensions. So
yeah,
you're still gonna have that as a core bit of the business.
Certainly. The voting generation, as they might be known.
Certainly.
I mean, we've got the budget obviously coming up at the end. How have the clients been over the last few months? Agitating like last year? Or?
I think it's the same story every time, and it's a case of you have a message of, you know, the Telegraph or any other newspaper.
Yeah.
Pushing some of the stories of will tax-free cash disappear or what's going to be increased from a tax point of view.
That story was them pushing it, really,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, I had a message on Monday, which was a lady saying, you know, can I have a quick call this week? And I was like, yeah, no problem at all. You know, what's it going to be about? And she's like, oh, you know, what's Rachel Reeves going to do next? And do I need to act with my tax-free cash? You know, if we had a pound for every time someone said in the past, you know, my tax-free cash is going to disappear, do I need to do something with it? So our starting point is always a plans for the long term. You know, don't panic and do something that's going to adversely affect you. But the fact that the likes of those Telegraph articles, you know, do start to have people asking those questions, it does almost, you know, start to upset, especially the shorter term investors. I think, you know, when you look at people who've reinvested 5 years plus, they've seen market volatility, they've seen budget volatility, they've seen political change, so they can actually sort of live through it quite easily. Someone who's retired, you know, in the last few years, they've been punched in the face a few times by the markets, and they possibly haven't got that time frame and that horizon to actually say we understand that it's stable. Again, we mentioned the defined benefit sort of permissions and transfers. Someone who hasn't taken investment risk in the past because a scheme's taken the risk, again, if they're making a life-changing decision to move money across, suddenly they're taking the investment risk. And again, I've got a client who really sticks in my head where his transfer landed the week before Russia invaded Ukraine. Again, you know, he has had the retirement he wants, but he has a few scars from the investment performance where it would have been a lot easier if he hadn't, you know, seen those losses straight away.
Yeah, hadn't tracked downwards. And I suppose that's just the investor confidence, isn't it? And if you've been doing it for a long time, then you have more experience, like anything, really.
Definitely. We tend to have a client conference in January where we invite people to come and hear from fund managers and economists.
Do all your clients, are they all of them invited?
We get everyone's invited and we get quite a good sort of turnout for that. But there's one table that always, you know, it's three people who live on the same street. And one guy's been invested for about, you know, he's been invested with us for about 7-8 years. The next guy has been invested for about 3 or 4. And the next one's been invested for 1 or 2. And I always joke to them that, you know, the one who's been through it all for the long term, he's super relaxed. He doesn't really worry. And he sort of says, you know, everything comes good in the end. We don't need to worry too much. You move down and it's a bit of a, you know, okay, I believe that, but still there's some volatility.
My money was here when I invested it.
100%. And then the next guy along, he's the one who's almost like, oof, I need a little bit more hand-holding. I need a little bit more reassurance. So I think that's very, you know, a good reminder to us that, you know, we have to be there as someone's trusted advisor to look after them and keep them going with a long-term plan. But equally, by educating clients on the journey and by helping them to understand and become a bit more confident, they start to help ride out the sort of roller coasters of the markets themselves.
Yeah. I suppose one thing that we do, or a few things that we do know are coming, is the IHT on pensions. We spoke before and you mentioned a few strategies that you've spoken to clients about. Gifting and annuities were two of those. Would you be able to?
100%. I think that's definitely a refocus of pensions with some people, and specifically those people who have almost ring-fenced the pension for next generation planning. There might have been some people who it was a case of, this is the most tax efficient way to leave it outside of my estate and I'll pass it down to potentially kids, grandchildren, perfect. With those sorts of clients, again, we've been picking it up and almost going, what is your objective and what does it look like? And one example that I've got recently is someone who's got a, you know, beneficiary drawdown plan where her husband sadly passed away before age 75. So it's tax free for her to access, you know, best part of £1 million. She's over 75. So if anything happens to her, you know, her daughter is going to be having that as, you know, taxable income going forward.
Clubbing, yeah.
Yeah. So and they've also got an inheritance tax problem, as you can imagine. So, you know, we've been talking about the idea with her of, you know, okay, can we use that pension fund that was previously allocated just to be passed down? Could we, you know, have that paid out? Can we think about things like a discounted gift trust? Can we think about absolute gifts to the daughter? And then can we also think about life insurance to cover the 7-year period and some of those bits? So it's fantastic planning opportunities, but people do start with the sentiment of, well, I've already paid a lot of tax. Why should I be taxed again? And you sort of have the bit of a political aggravation to start with before people then start to say, okay, well, yes, let's come to terms with the change in landscape and what we do next going forward.
Got to face up to it, yeah, as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I was just going to say, and it's a funny one as well, because you're then engaging with the next generation. And this example, you know, a lady in her 40s, she's still working, and then she's, you know, potentially inheriting, you know, best part of £1 million. We then also having that conversation with her to how does that reframe her objectives? Does that make her want to retire early? Does she want to pass wealth down to her own children? And it's those interesting bits of, you know, lots of generational wealth was passed on previously on death. More we're seeing, you know, gifts out of surplus income, and more, you know, people making gifts in their lifetime, which is, you know, really powerful for money passing down the generations. But it also presents that bit of, you know, people who might not have had a lot of money suddenly presented with a, oh gosh, what do I do with it? And it's not just solving one person's inheritance tax problem, because potentially then the next generation has the same problem going forward.
Yeah. How have you found the providers? They're all sort of starting to offer their annuity products.
Yeah, I think providers are an interesting one. You know, when we first saw annuity spike with interest rates, you know, going up, it was a case of, okay, you know, be honest with you, we've got two people who work in our annuities team. One of them is on holiday. We don't really know how we're going to cope with the demand. And yes, they've had to scale up, but it has been a slow process. Again, when we've been sort of focused on outcomes and how we can, you know, lock in guaranteed income for some people, we had a period of time where, you know, when annuity rates did spike, we were going for, you know, partial annuities, potentially to cover, you know, essential expenditure or covering people's personal allowance before they get to state pension and other things. So annuities have been a fantastic way of solving some objective, and especially, you know, low risk clients. We've had some, you know, initial chats over the last, you know, year where someone doesn't like what's happened in the market so far, and when you show them the guaranteed income they can have for the rest of their life, they almost go, perfect, where can I sign?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's also structuring that to say, do you want inflation escalation, or do you want that income to naturally taper with inflation? And people then thinking about the death benefits. And I think, you know, the idea of a single life annuity with a 30-year guarantee level in payment, that can tick a lot of people's objectives if they haven't got the appetite for risk to do drawdown and to stay invested, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Over the past few years, there's obviously been quite a lot of regulatory change. I suppose maybe you can track it back to Consumer Duty in July 2023. So almost over 2 years over now. How did that sort of change the structure of the business or the proposition, if at all?
Yeah, so I think, I suppose unpopular opinion is, I don't think Consumer Duty impacted us a lot, because we already were tracking lots of data and we were already trying to focus on outcomes and were sort of on the front foot from that point of view. You know, one of the things that I think we do really well, as I mentioned earlier, is the sort of technology side of things. And we do have a product that we use called Datavana, which is almost a hub between a back office system and our platforms. And with that data, we can then start to say, okay, if the FCA ask for you know, a list of information on, you know, client demographic, withdrawal rates, vulnerability. We can do that
as they have done recently.
Yeah. We can do that at a touch of a button with those sorts of support and those providers. And that way we haven't really had to change a lot, but you can see how, maybe some of the older firms or the, you know, one man bands who maybe had a filing cabinet and had less data, they obviously have headaches trying to, you know, answer questions and demonstrate the outcomes. But I think taking it back to that fiercely independent bit, you know, if we really are focusing at, you know, what clients want and having their outcomes at the heart of the business, then Consumer Duty was almost a, well, why haven't the FCA been doing this for years?
Yeah. How was responding to that survey? It was quite funny because you guys had obviously all been told by the FCA post the ongoing advice review that they were going to take a step back from regulation, and they sent a big survey. I got sent it by somebody. It was quite extensive.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I read through it and I think, you know, the FCA, you know, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, in the sense of they're almost gathering that information by the look of it to then see where's the areas that they need to focus more on, where do they need to ask more questions. So you don't blame them for asking it. I think the frustrating thing as a business is when we look at it and we say, well, we already give you that data with a return here, or we already give you that data somewhere else, so why don't you look at it yourself rather than asking for it again? But yeah, I think the FCA, you know, at times they could actually do more of a job to be more helpful in supporting the industry. I mean, we have people who joke about, you know, a financial advisor on a jet ski, you know, as a rip-off merchant, because that's the FCA's type advert that they put on a telly, rather than promoting what good the industry does and how to find a really good, you know, independent advisor in your local area. So I think that's the challenge. And, you know, we mentioned providers and annuity providers before. Again, we find some of the most frustrating things for clients can be how slowly pension providers or defined benefit, you know, administrators can be at responding to queries and clients. And ultimately, that's an area where, you know, the FCA doesn't seem to have much of a focus, and providers can sort of get away with whatever they want. I had a client the other day who was, you know, complaining himself, and he was saying, well, if this was how I did business, or if this was how Wealth Advice did business, you'd be quickly out of business.
Yeah. So one of the big providers.
Yeah, one of the big providers, where it's a case of, you know, they almost feel like they're sort of too big to fail, and they'll just do what
they
want.
There are loads of other clients that they deal with, right?
Exactly. So I think that's the bit that, you know, we could have improvement, and I think that would help with outcomes. But overall, you know, we do a good job with, you know, the data and the client sort of satisfaction and surveys and things to be able to quite quickly demonstrate what we do is in keeping with the likes of Consumer Duty.
Yeah, absolutely. And just on your sort of assets under advice and management and allocations, so 19% of funds, or around 20% of funds, are in actively managed products, just 6% in passive products. Why is that?
So I find that when you fill in questionnaires like that and you start answering the split between active and passive, there becomes a blurred line, and we have what we would say is, you know, actively passive investments. So we have an asset allocation which is active, but the building blocks below that can be passive. So I think sometimes that can almost lose a bit of the detail. We have an insourced sort of, you know, model portfolio, so to speak, where we have a relationship with Elston Consulting, who sit on our asset allocation committee.
On your investment.
On an investment process. So they feed in with a lot of data and a lot of ideas. And ultimately then, if it's a building block that is active or passive, well, we go with what the data says and what's the right thing for that area. So today we heard a lot about, you know, how certain sectors you can really just say a passive approach works and we'll go as cheap as possible. And then on other sectors, especially with risk management, the active side of it can really add value. So I think that's where there's never going to be a winner on the active versus passive debate, because depending on market conditions, you know, one side is always going to have, you know, more of an argument and more of a voice. And we want to almost be agnostic in that sense, but at the same time being cost focused and performance focused, to then say, you know, we're happy to go with the track records and what adds value.
I suppose connected to those investment committee meetings, how have they been this year? Have there been sort of changes in strategy as a result of
America? I mean, we tweak things, but we try and not tweak things too often. So again, it's that element of being active with the asset allocation, but almost saying, so for our sort of moderately speculative portfolio with 60% in equities, you know, we could go as high as 66%, or we could also drop the equities down. There's definitely a time when, for example, during Trump's volatility, when you go, oh, I wish we were on the defensive side of it. But equally then, once that happens, you almost say, okay, well, you know, we want to go back overweight because we can see this coming through. So I think that's where, I mean, going back to the client communication and the YouTube sort of videos, you know, we do a monthly market update exactly for that reason, to let clients know what decisions are being made, what's being tweaked, and what we're seeing in the world, so that it is a case of we don't need to panic. You know, we had a client in the past who was an area manager at Currys PC World, and he couldn't get his head around the idea that an investment proposition wasn't like selling a television, and whichever one you put by the door did best. And he almost thought, okay, well, if it's not working today, let's swap it round. Let's put the next television by the door and the sales will go up. So he would almost say, okay, if you've had 6 months where the markets have done not much, what's the new idea? What's the new plan? Again, we know that
quite bad investment.
Yeah, exactly. We know that investing's for the long term. So the main thing we had to do with a client like that was the educational piece and the, you know, don't worry, this isn't short term. We're here for a 20-year, 30-year investment horizon. So it's going back to basics with data and examples like that, which I think adds a lot of value. But you can see, you know, it's his life lessons, it's his experiences, and that's what sticks in his head. And again, you know, good client relationship is understanding what brings someone to the table relationship wise and experience wise, and then saying, okay, what's useful and what's not. Again, we heard at lunchtime, you know, from a psychologist talking about the value of money and how people, you know, value it differently. I think our job is very much about understanding client objectives and what they feel about money before they then start to spend more, gift more, use it. Because ultimately, if we haven't worked out what the ultimate objective is, we might be purely trying to make people money without actually knowing, is it to gift more? Is it to spend more? Is it to enjoy more? You know, is it to, you know, try and pass on more wealth? So I think that's the bits that we need to help and unpick, certainly.
Yeah. How does your background in sort of how does your computer science master's PhD, how has that sort of impacted your investment decisions, or cause you sort of attracted to small AI startups?
Well,
and stuff like that.
It's funny. I think sometimes it's the other way. I mean, for my master's project, I made my own cryptocurrency.
Oh wow!
So then, when a few clients started
when
clients then started asking questions about should we be holding it, you know, with a regulated advisor hat on, I'm there going, well, it's not a listed, you know, it's not something we can provide advice on. Again, we know that sort of moved and changed a little bit. But I think for me, you know, yes, technology is important, and yes, we want to use AI, and we want to see how that can improve markets, but you also don't want to be looking at fads. And again, you know, today we heard from people talking about how well the likes of the Magnificent Seven have done, but then equally in the same voice, someone else might say, well, what about the dot-com bubble and what about things to worry about? So I think it's all about managing the pros and cons of these things. But I think in general, being able to talk to clients about the themes and technology definitely works. And from our own business, you know, how can we integrate AI tools and Microsoft tools and other bits to make sure that we are being as efficient as possible so that we can spend time, you know, caring for clients and helping them, which is ultimately is the important bit of our role.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Perfect. Thank you very much for having me.
That was fantastic.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.